Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by UC Santa Cruz, chosen by the National Cancer Institute to launch the Cancer Genomics Hub in the quest to decode cancer. More information available at ucsc.edu.
Good morning. I'm Rachel Miro, and this is the California Report. California has the toughest standards for hazardous waste management in the country. But a new report expected out today claims the state agency charged with going after toxic polluters is biased toward industry. The California Report's Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca explains.
Each year, Californians generate 2 million tons of hazardous waste from sources like gas stations, dry cleaners, and aerospace companies. The State Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC, regulates that waste, issuing permits and fining polluters. But in a scathing 68-page report, the Santa Monica-based advocacy group Consumer Watchdog argues the DTSC isn't doing its job. Report author Lisa Tucker says the agency rarely refers cases for criminal prosecution, instead letting repeat offenders get away with nothing more than a slap on the wrist.
It refuses to revoke the permits of serial polluters, regular people in communities bombarded by toxic pollutants. Have had enough.
Officials from the Department of Toxic Substances Control have yet to read the report, but acknowledge there are problems and say the agency has already launched an independent review of its permitting process. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
The State Water Resources Control Board is urging state lawmakers to tax fertilizer purchases or levy some kind of local fee to help pay for new water systems in agricultural areas with high nitrate levels in the drinking water. The recommendation comes in a report that points out groundwater contamination is a pervasive problem in the Salinas Valley, as well as Fresno, Tulare, Kings, and Kern counties, affecting 2.5 million people, many of whom end up paying for bottled water out of pocket. On the heels of the report, four ag area lawmakers announced they've introduced a package of 9 bills to address the issue. More than 10,000 lawsuits have been filed against a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson over an artificial hip that it's since taken off the market, the DePuy Orthopedics ASR metal hip. So in other words, about 1 out of every 3 people who got one of these hips in the U.S. is suing. The first case to go to trial is underway in Los Angeles, and David Voriakis has been covering it for Bloomberg News.
Essentially, the lawsuits claim that Johnson & Johnson knew for several years before the recall that there were surgeons who had implanted the hips who were complaining about problems with those hips, and the complaints involved joint dislocation, pain, and because of the design of the cup, it caused metal ions to shed into the surrounding tissue and bloodstream of patients. But the company contends that it safely designed the ASR hip, and that once the evidence was compelling enough, then they acted responsibly in pulling it off the market.
And when we're talking about artificial hips, they tend to last, what, about 15 years? So practically what this means for somebody who has a hip that's not settling in well is that they have to go back into surgery and the lengthy recovery that follows within a few years.
Right. The second surgery, the follow-up surgery, is known as a revision surgery. And surgeons generally say that that is more difficult to execute and more painful for the patients.
So the company is denying the plaintiff's claims, which legally include failure to warn, defective design, negligent recall. It seems in plain English that what the plaintiff is arguing is that Johnson & Johnson knew early enough that it should have taken away these products from the market, but then delayed doing so?
Right. The case essentially is that Johnson & Johnson knew that there were problems with the product, they inadequately tested it, and they put it on the market anyway, and that soon after that, complaints began coming into the company from surgeons about problems with their patients, and that the company became quite concerned, and there was an active debate internally among some people at the company about what to do. And in fact, in 2008, there was a committee that was convened to look at the possibility of redesigning the cup in the hip. That was called Project Alpha. And in the end, the company scrapped it.
It's interesting that you mention this internal debate inside the company, but it's after the fact, after the product is rolled out, so to speak. The Food and Drug Administration is just now proposing that makers of artificial hips with all metal components should have to prove the devices are safe and effective with clinical trials. It's actually not required that they have to do that before a product goes to market?
Right. Medical devices do not have to undergo clinical testing the way drugs do. Manufacturers have to show that a device is substantially equivalent, that's the standard, to other approved devices on the market. The underlying assumption is that the devices are safe and effective, but that doesn't necessarily mean that any one device has been clinically tested to show that it is, in fact, safe and effective.
Talk about the role of consulting physicians in all of this. They make money when the hip is implanted in somebody else's practice. That seems like it would have a dampening effect on public criticism of a product that's not working.
A lot of the medical devices are designed by companies in close consultation with doctors who use them, and then those doctors get royalties when the devices are sold. And there's been a lot of questions about whether this leads to conflicts of interest and the disclosures that doctors need to make about their role in designing and implanting devices.
So there are 7,200 cases pending in federal court in Toledo, Ohio, 2,000 cases pending in state court in San Francisco. What does this case in L.A. mean for all those cases lined up behind it?
Well, lawyers involved in this litigation generally believe that the company is going to settle all of the deserving cases in the end and that they all won't go to trial. There are three cases that are scheduled for trial. It's the outcome of these early cases that will help determine the parameters of what the company may pay in the end to resolve all the rest of the cases.
Well, David Voriakis, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
David Voriakis has been covering the case for Bloomberg News. You'll find a link to his coverage online at californiareport.org. That's the California Report for Thursday, February 21st, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2013 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com. And Barracuda Networks, innovators of simple solutions to complex IT problems, such as email archiving for compliance and litigation readiness. Barracuda.com.